Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, second research symposium on the late effects of poliomyelitis. Tape number 9, session number 4.
We're in session entitled The Clinical Pathological Correlation, and I've already had numerous requests for extra time in people's talks, so I guess we better get started. Our first speaker is Bridget Obom from the University of Copenhagen, and her title of her talk is Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, Functional, Morphologic, and Serologic Investigations. Bridget.
Under the title Functional, Morphologic, and Serologic Investigation of Poliomyelitis Sequelae, I will present for you a preliminary study issued from the National Society Against Poliomyelitis in cooperation with several departments at the State University Hospital in Denmark. The impetus to this research originated from the first symposium on late effect on poliomyelitis held here in Warm Springs, Georgia, 1984, in which Ms. Erbo Larsen, which is the chief physician at the National Society Against Polio, was a participant. National Society Against Polio is the only clinic concerning polio in my country. The clinic was founded in 46, and it works as an outpatient clinic for polio patients, and we have about 3,000. Together we have set up a clinical research in cooperation with the several departments. To present myself first, I'm the clinical coordinator. I'm doctor at the Department of Rheumatology and Rehabilitation. In order to approach an explanation or a cause of the new muscular problems seen among patients with former polio, we are investigating a carefully characterized group of patients with former polio in one leg, more precisely in one quadriceps, sparing or approximately sparing the opposite leg. We are interested in patients who have been lived well compensated for now 30 or 40 years, well compensated defined as ability to work, start a family, drive a car, etc., without ambulatory aids. Suddenly or gradually over the recent years, they experienced new symptoms as fatigue, weakness, pain or fasciculation in the former well compensated leg, and they decline in functional group as an example from group 5 to 4, measured on the scale from 5 to 0. By using this model, we have a patient with former polio in one muscle quadriceps and one without. We are aware of the fact that you can't be sure of that the muscle is affected so selectively and that the other leg probably were infected too. But we find that this fact might be of even greater interest because the patient has only complaints from one leg. At the moment, we have been in contact with 10 patients, of which the majority had gone through a series of investigations. We've done history, computer tomographic scanning, muscle biopsy, bone mineral content, and laboratory findings. The first part is concerning present complaint and the onset, duration, character, influence on daily life, need of ambulatory aids, walk distance, stair climbing, raising from sitting to standing position, car driving, and influence on employment and family. Next part concerning initial episode of acute polio, the age at onset, severity, need for hospitalization or how long, degree of paresis and duration of paresis, and if possible the initial kind of treatment. And the third part is a further medical and surgical history, the clinical examination with strength measurements and degree of atrophy in circumference. The next slide present for you our 10 patients. The majority of the patients are female except one, the majority age group 30s to 40s, and they had the acute polio in childhood. All of the patients had contacted the National Society Against Polio the last 2 or 3 years because of new muscular symptoms. The majority had acute polio in 1952, the year of the dramatic epidemic in Denmark, and the last two columns shows the year of the first appearance of post-polio symptoms and the amounts of years between initial episode and the debut of symptoms. Next slide shows our result of the clinical examination. You see in column 3 the degree of atrophy, and the last two columns show strength measurements from muscle quadriceps. Last, I will show for you a full muscle scheme of one of our patients. In 52, at the age of 2 years, this patient suffered acute polioparesis of left leg and duration of paresis for 3 weeks, recovery to approximately full strength. She has been working full-time as a bookbinder, have a husband, 3 children, and been living an active life with daily rides on bicycle. In fall 85, she develops pain in left leg, and she has been absent owing to illness since January 86. Not only pain, she has been unable to depress the clutch while driving a car. But what's going on in this muscle? We can measure a degree of atrophy, but we don't know the nature of the atrophy. To approach these questions, we collected muscle biopsies by needle technique from both muscle quadriceps, vastus lateralis, and made computer tomographic scanning at exactly the same level. Even though computer tomography scan is put to an extensive use for the examination of almost every part of the body, only a few reports have described the computer tomography of the musculoskeletal system and myopathies. In neurogenic myopathies, the most common lesion consists of breaks in the periphery of the muscle in association with patches and radiation stria of fibroadipose tissue. We have taken 8 pieces around the middle of the thigh between spina iliaca anterior superior and the patella. And I'll first show for you a normal... You do it. I'll show for you a normal computer tomographic scanning of the thigh, and mark 1 is the place where we take the needle biopsy. Next slide shows for you a typical patient with former polio and left leg atrophy of 5.2 centimeters. You see an obvious destruction of ordinary muscle configuration, isolated islands of muscle tissue. And you now see this, the same left leg in magnification. And this shows you first that we have difficulties in taking biopsies in some of our patients in this area, and point 2 shows a bulk of muscle tissue with the density of muscle without infiltration of fat. Next slide shows, the next 2 slides show the two patients of which you saw the muscle scheme in the beginning of this speech. And by this technique we have done a reconstruction of the muscle bulk. You see here? And in the next slides we'll show for you the leg with symptoms and with a more severe paresis. Muscle biopsies were taken from musculus quadris lateralis. We use the technique of needle biopsy, which is a more general technique than ordinary surgery biopsies, and there's a healing with a minimal of scarring. It shows the size of the biopsy. We use the histochemical method, hematoxylin, phengesin, atipase, NADH, and alpha-glucosylphosphate dehydrogenase. The next slide shows for you an example of a normal muscle with a description of fibrotyping. We had, at this moment, muscle biopsies from 6 patients. The first slide in H&E shows muscle quadriceps with symptoms related to post-polio symptoms. We find a differentiation in fiber size. We find a group of atrophic fibers in the center. And we find no sign in none of our biopsies of inflammation, fat, of infiltration of connective tissue. This is in Phengesin stain. Our enzyme stains will reveal that it's a type 2 atrophy. It's the same part that you saw in the first picture. And this is again the same part. The next slide will show for you that we found again this part of it, and we found grouping of fibers, and in this you find type 1 light in this stain. It's an NADH. Next slide show for you muscle craterships without symptoms. There was no history about paresis in this leg. And the picture shows still variation in fiber size. And if you look at this little piece, the atopasia stain reveals that there's a type 2 atrophy and a type 1 regrouping. This is again our patient with the muscle scheme you saw before. She had a leg with polio, but this leg has recovered to normal function. She had been a bit of paresis in this leg all through the life. She now have symptoms in this leg, but we wasn't able to get biopsy from this leg. We have biopsy from the other leg. And again, in this biopsy, we find atrophic fibers. Finally, we have 6 biopsies from both legs, 2 patients with neurogenic atrophy in leg with post-polio symptoms, and slight type 2 atrophy in leg without symptoms. We have 2 patients with only biopsy from one leg, the leg without symptoms, which revealed severe sign of neurogenic atrophy with small type 2 fibers and type 1 regrouping. And in the last 2, only a minor atrophy of single type 2 fibers was seen in the paratic as well as in the clinical normal leg. This was the patient showed before in atopasia. The atrophic fiber showed it is atrophy of type 2 fibers. For the quantitative assessment of the bone loss in the axial and peripheral skeleton, we have measured the bone mineral content by dual photon scanning. The bone mineral content is measured in the lumbar spine, in the femoral shaft, and in the proximal part of tibia. 6 patients are investigated at the time being, and our preliminary results show a marked reduced bone mineral content in former paralyzed extremity about 20-50% compared to the other leg. The bone mineral is not only due to a minor load, because we found one patient with less bone mineral in the former paralyzed arm compared to the other. On this little material, it seems as if the paresis influenced the bone mineral, even though the patient had loaded the legs identically. Finally, I will present for you our laboratory findings, and we found in this no sign of immunologic activation or reactivation of virus. That's a lot of information there. Yes, and I will finally thank Dr. Halstead for giving me the opportunity to come here.
The questions. I just want you to clarify one point I didn't quite understand. How many of your patients had grouped atrophy on those muscle biopsies? Was it just that one, or was it more than one had grouped atrophy as opposed to individual fiber atrophy?
Yes. We found 4 patients with group atrophy. We have only 6 biopsies, we have 6 patients, but biopsy from both legs. one with symptoms and one without symptoms. But it's preliminary, and we have our material so little. I'm looking forward to hear the other results today.
Are these biopsies with group atrophy from limbs that they have been affected before and they had residual deficit?
We found both.
I mean, in other words, did you find group atrophy in muscles that have been affected or not affected before by the original disease and they have been normal now? They have been normal before the new symptoms started. In other words, patients who have... did you find group atrophy in muscles that have been recovered completely from the original disease?
Yes, we have found that.
You did find them?
Yes.
How many of those?
It's only one. Yes. But we use the technique of needle biopsy.
So you find one, is that right?
Mm.
Group atrophy?
Let's clarify that. It was one muscle biopsy out of six from patients with no residual weakness from the original disease showed group atrophy. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Delacas.
Mazar Javid, Philadelphia. I have a criticism of needle biopsies in general, particularly for this sort of evaluations, because in normal muscles, I think it's easier to compare a needle biopsy to normal muscle, that's all right. But when you have polio, you are affecting at random, and different muscles might be affected. Second point, most of the needle biopsies are taken from vastus lateralis, and I think there are some other muscles that were affected in this study, as well as one presented this morning, that you are not so sure whether you are getting into the same area all the time when you are taking the biopsies. My question to you is that when you are comparing just vastus lateralis, and in your CAT scanning, you are demonstrating atrophy of other muscles, you do not know what extent of polio effect that was in one muscle versus the other, and how valid would be the comparison.
No, we are aware that this comparison is not, it's not so good. But we think we could get some information out of this material going on this way, even though.
Maynard, I just wanted to clarify, I'm still not sure that I understood you either. You did say there were six subjects that you had where you biopsied both legs, both
yes.
A symptomatic leg and an unsymptomatic leg.
Yes, two of these six patients, we did not get the biopsy from the symptomatic leg. It was difficult to draw out.
So there were only four that had the double biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
And were there in summation any, you know, major differences that were, you know, routinely found between the symptomatic and the non-symptomatic leg in those four or not? That's what I wasn't sure.
Yes, no, we found pathological features in all of the biopsies. We found group 2 atrophy in all biopsies. We don't find, no, not yet.
Antel Montreal, you mentioned that your clinic has been operating since 1946. It would be interesting to know whether some of the patients who came to you after the 1952 epidemic, have any of them been followed all these years? And do you have longitudinal data that many of us have been asking about? Have some of them been documented by clinical exams beginning weaker over the years? And do you have spinal fluid frozen away on some of your patients?
No, we haven't got frozen spinal fluid. But we have a clinical observation of these patients. I show you this muscle scheme back from 52, and the new one made this summer.
Do you have a sense? For some of the patients who've been followed for 30 years, if you look back on clinical records, do you get a sense or documentation that in fact a goodly number of them have been getting weaker over the last 5 or 10 years?
Yes, we have. I showed for you the muscle scheme. It was maybe too quick, but it showed the decrease in the degree of weakness.
Thank you very much, Dr. Obama. Okay, our next speaker is Dr. Pezispur from Air Force Institute of Pathology, also known as Dr. Pez, and his topic of discussion is pathologic observations in the spinal cord of post-polio patients.
Much simpler, yes.
Okay. Can you have it?
This.
That's all right. Yeah. Can you hear me on these? All right, so then I take this one. Thanks.
That's all right.
All right, thank you.
That's all right.
We can do that. Before I start, I just wanted to give an introduction to the reason for the study. The paralytic variant of poliomyelitis is an acute self-limiting disorder in which if the patient dies, and that's what happens most of the time, or fortunately less these days, that is the pathology that the pathologist sees and gets a chance to examine in the autopsy room. In these conditions, as one can appreciate, and I'm not going to belabor on these facts because they have been discussed by Dr. Bodian last meeting here, is that one sees hemorrhagic necrosis of the anterior parts of the spinal cord, as shown here by this ferrocyanide stain on gross specimen. You see that it has turned everything blue here. Then if one goes to a large section, one sees just hemorrhagic necrosis and some bluish dots that reflect on the inflammatory response. The inflammation is in the first 1 or 2 days of the process, mostly polymorphonuclear leukocytic, and then later it becomes mostly lymphocytic and macrophagic. Here we have perivascular inflammation, we have evidence of neuronophagia, some neurons are disappearing already, some are being digested and so on. And then later we just see a macrophagic lymphoplasmacytic infiltrate in the anterior gray matter of the spinal cord. This is the neuronophagia, and the sort of non-characteristic intranuclear inclusion that everybody refers to as Caudry type B inclusion is non-specific, and you can see it in other types of pathology in the central nervous system. Now, if the patient does not die from these, he usually has a regular lifespan. Normally, he lives around 70, 75 years of age, and then he might die from unrelated causes. And that's the time that one sees a spinal cord like this. And these are the only textbook pictures that are available for the time being, at least, in neuropathology. That you look at the spinal cord of a patient, you see that basically the white matter is intact on the surface, and this is one of the characteristics that distinguishes post-polio cases from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. In addition to that, we see that the anterior gray matter on both sides or unilaterally is rarefied, cavitated, necrotic, whatever you want to call it. Now, surprisingly, if you look into the literature, there is very minimal information available of what happens between these two ends of the spectrum. On one side, you have an acute inflammatory disease leading to paraplegia and in the height of the disease to death, and at the other end, a spinal cord that is cavitated and sort of end stage. The only human study on this topic comes from Pierce, James Pierce from NIH, almost in 1943. He published a series of 3 patients ranging from, I think, 7 to 19 weeks in their life after the first acute attack of poliomyelitis. And there is Bettina Warburg's study in 1931 who studied the repair process in the spinal cord of 15 monkeys who fortunately for the researcher had stayed alive up to 1 year after the acute attack of polio, and she was interested in seeing what happens in between these two ends of the spectrum of pathology. So after the upsurge of interest in the post-polio syndrome, I'm not going to get into the politics of the names, I got interested in seeing if we have anything in the files of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. By the way, these armed forces, they are very sort of sensitive to not to call it Air Force Institute of Pathology. It's armed forces. At any rate, this is the patient with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. As we see, the anterior areas of the gray matter are a little rarefied, but they are not really shriveled or sort of cavitated like we see in polio. The dorsal roots, as you see, are well preserved, while the anterior roots are extremely atrophic and thinned out. And the characteristic change of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis is this pallor and demyelination of the crust and uncrust pyramidal tracts that we see in the spinal cord. And this picture we have never observed in these post-polio spinal cord. From the files of the Institute, I was able to, maybe we could make this a little larger for the interest of the audience. We were able to find 7 well-documented clinically cases of poliomyelitis after the acute attack of which the patient had survived in these ranges. Before you ask, I'll tell you that this order of patients is the order that they have come to the AFIP for consultation. It's not my selection. You see, for example, this one came later than that one, so that's why we gave it. Now here we have basically 4 men and 3 women, ages at the time of death ranging from almost 36 to 61 years of age, which is a sort of lucky number for me because I was worried we might be dealing with the senility changes in the spinal cord of the patients that are well known with the dropout of the anterior horn cells and so on. And so these are around the age that usually we don't have that much neuronal dropout in that area. Now, sexes, we said the post-polio per number of years, we range from 9 months, 3/4 of a year, to 44 years post-polio. And I'll discuss this patient for you later in a little more detail. Now, as we see, the clinical status of these patients was that 2 of them were stable post-polio. One of them was paraplegic since 23 years of age and no new symptoms till he died at 46. And the other one stable for 31 years post-polio, and he died at the age of 58. We have 2 cases that will fit the description of post-polio symptoms. And this is one patient that was 29 years post-polio, was stable till 1 year prior to death, that developed pain and new weakness in the lower extremities. And there was another one that was stable until 2 years before his death, when new upper and lower extremity weaknesses developed. And these 2 patients died from unrelated causes, by the way. One of them, some bronchopneumonia, and the other one from, cancer. Then we had 3 patients who were on respirator till almost they died, especially this one in 9 months after his attack of paralytic poliomyelitis. Now, these are the pathological changes we see. We have seen this part of the table before. As we see, I tried to divide in a much larger scale, but then of course I had to cut it for the sake of presentation. If we can, take a look at, there are nerve roots on the other side of the field. We can move this a little here, thank you. We have neuronal loss in between 2 to 4 plus on the anterior gray matter of the cord. We have neuronal atrophy in the remaining nerve cells. I really could not see, and honest to goodness, neuronophagia, but there is glial nodules in the gray matter. We have active gliosis, inflammation, lymphocytic, and in 2 patients, plasmacytic. We have white matter, which is minimally rarefied, and of course that's understandable. Why? Because it is impossible that you have fiber dropout and no response to that. So that's different from what you see in the cases of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, where you have demyelination and in the face of more or less normal-looking corticospinal tract. Now, in the nerve roots, we have atrophy of the anterior roots. Now, I just wanted to show you a couple of these pictures. This is the patient who died 9 months after his attack of poliomyelitis. As we see, the spinal cord basically doesn't show much except that the anterior gray matter is sort of hypercellular with some bluish areas on it. Now, if we go closer, we see there is definitely evidence of active inflammation. Here we have perivascular lymphocytic and plasmacytic infiltration. Here we have plasmacytic lymphocytic infiltration. We have macrophagic response here. We have some neurons that are dropped out. We have some neurons that are undergoing atrophy and so on. And in a closer view, we can easily pick up the lymphocytes and plasmacytes in this area. We can appreciate the active astrocytic gliosis that is trying to compensate for the lost substance. And we can see the focus of neuronophagia or glial nodule that is here. Those who are familiar with morphology can easily see plasma cells and reactive astrocytes, very ugly looking in this background, that is becoming rarefied. Now this patient is 9 months after the acute attack of poliomyelitis. He died on respirator, and the case has been sent to us actually from somewhere in, I think, South America is a country, I can't locate the name now, to Dr. Webb Haymaker with the question why there is so much inflammation 9 months after poliomyelitis. So this is the 9 months post-polio case. Then we have this patient that was 5.5 years after poliomyelitis, and this is the one that also died on respirator. This patient has a picture of infarcting the anterior gray matter of the spinal cord. You see there is hemorrhage in it. Everything is almost wiped out. And if we go to the other side of the cord, we see there is still active gliosis going on. There is inflammatory response in the background. There are some macrophages, as evidenced by these sort of clear halos around them. Remember that this is, we are in the anterior gray, and this is extremely depopulated as far as the number of neurons is concerned. Another view from the same thing, going into the even the intermediate lateral columns of the cord. Inflammation is easily appreciated, early cavitation and response by the astrocytes. This is from one of the post-polio patients. As we see here, I'm sorry, in this one we still have no evidence of corticospinal tract degeneration or demyelination, only some mild gliosis of the posterior columns. As we see, the anterior horns are not depicted easily in this view, but there is a lymphoplasmacell infiltrate in the sort of peduncular fissure or anterior gray fissure of the spinal cord. Then we come to the center of Badel. We see a large number of nerve cells that are sort of swollen, as Dr. Dalakos showed you yesterday, like chromatolytic. We have a lot of hypercellularity, obviously, and even for those who are not morphologists, they can easily pick up cellular unrest in this field. Now, in addition to that, we have numerous swollen degenerating axons, and we have, again, reactive gliosis. A closer view shows some neurons with the nuclei is being pushed to the periphery, like chromatolysis, a dystrophic axon, some lymphocytes in the background, some neuron that is becoming homogenized and dying. So this is the patient 29 years post-polio with a sort of new symptoms. This one is from the last case of stable post-polio. This patient was 31 years after his attack of poliomyelitis, and as we can still appreciate, you see this area of the anterior gray matter of the cord is extremely hypercellular, and this is reflected by the presence of large numbers of reactive astrocytes and occasional inflammatory cells. Now, if we go to an adjacent field, one can see presence of inflammatory infiltrates around the blood vessels, some neurons that are dying and they are becoming calcified, and the obvious hypercellularity in the anterior gray matter of the spinal cord. Now, as I promised Dr. Halstead, I'm going to discuss the case of was 44 years post-poliomyelitis and had new symptomatology as the prototype of the disease. We can all read from this that The patient was a female, 61 years old at the time of her death in 1982. She had polymyelitis at age 17, weakness of lower extremities right more than left. 3 years prior to death, suffered fracture right lower extremity, wheelchair bound since then. 2 years prior to death, worsening lower extremity weakness, and she had no upper sphincter or upper extremity or sphinctric complaints. In other words, she does not have any problems with other fibers. Now, the neuromuscular evaluation showed a sensory autonomic function that was intact. The reflexes in the upper extremities were 2 to 3 plus, in the lower extremities were less. Strength in the upper extremities 4 to 5, lower extremities as we can see, hip flexion 1 and 3, quads 2 and 3, and hamstrings 2 and 3. These are all done by the clinician. As you pathologist, I have rarely touched a live person for the sake of examination. Now, tone is decreased in lower extremity. And so let's look at the cord of this patient. This spinal cord shows basically, of course, aside from the deformity due to pressure of nerve and so on, we see that the anterior gray matter here is extremely thinned out and sort of pale compared to the white matter. Now, if you come closer, we see that basically in this area, this is the lumbar area of the spinal cord. We see basically no nerve cells left here and only one large nerve cell left there. The rest of it is almost completely wiped out. But then we come to the cervical, to thoracic regions of the spinal cord. Here, what do we see? To begin with, we see that the corticospinal tracts are intact. We have the anterior gray matter of the cord, which is more or less wiped out, but one side more severe than the other. You can easily see this, that this area is completely sort of white, while this one has some remaining areas in between. And then we go closer, we see that although on that side, we have much less neurons, here is not that bad really. They are well preserved, or at least there are some nerve cells left. Now we go closer to the less affected side. We see basically a good component of more or less normal looking nerve cells. Some of them are atrophic, but this atrophy cannot be honestly evaluated as a result of the large volume of the nerve cell, that it depends on the plane of your cut. If you cut it on the top of it, it will be very small. If you cut it in the center, it might be a bigger one. But generally, there is a depopulation of nerve cell. This is on the less affected part of the spinal cord, and we don't have that much astrocytic response, occasional reactive astrocytes here. But then we go to the contralateral side and we hardly see any nerve cells left. We see that there is these axonal spheroids, as probably indicating damage to the axons or nerve cells. We have a more or less prominent glial, astroglial proliferation as identified by these cells, and of course inflammation in other parts. This Bodian stain I used just to confirm the presence of axonal spheroids, as we see in these areas of the spinal cord of this patient. So what am I saying after all this is that in some patients, probably polymyelitis never is healed. I don't know why, but it might be that it goes on as a smoldering infection, number one. Number two is that apparently from what we have is that post-polio syndrome does not have morphologically that many resemblances to the amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Thank you.
Jasper Dalby, fascinating and very provocative presentation. A couple of questions. In looking at the tissue, did you also examine cortical neurons for any evidence of involvement? And what about the interneurons in the anterior horn? Were they equally affected? And finally, where there was post-polio muscular atrophy, as you defined it clinically, did you see anything that related in the biopsy directly to that atrophy that wasn't present elsewhere?
To answer your first question, no. We didn't look at the cortical neurons. You mean cerebral cortical neurons? No, sir, no, we didn't. The second question about the interneurons, one can more or less speculate. We studied all of these sections with the variety of available histological sections for axons, for nerve cells, for myelin. And there is a depopulation, but to put your finger down on it and say, look, this is an interneuron, it is an extremely difficult task to do, really, at least for me. See? Now, regarding the third one, these are all autopsies, and I do not have any of these patients sort of, I don't recall that they have been biopsied for something. So the history of post-polio is based on the clinical and the pathology, whatever is there.
I understand that, but then when you looked at the spinal cord, were there areas in the cord that corresponded to the, that were different, that corresponded to the area of progression?
Oh yes, we had areas in between that were much, much less severely affected, definitely. For example, the thoracic parts of the spinal cord, in almost all of these seven patients, were more or less spared, or were not that badly involved. While what we saw mostly was in the lumbar and then in the cervical portions of the cord, which is basically a known fact in polio and other parts.
Bradley, this is really very exciting material because you have such unusual experience, and it's very important, obviously, the maximum we gained out of that material. The inflammatory change is obviously one of the things that was striking to you and is a surprise to most of us. And so I have two questions related to that. One is, have you done any T-cell lymphocyte markers to both confirm that they are lymphocytes there and what variety they are? And the second, any electron microscopy looking for viral virions, virus-like particles?
No, really. The answer to the first question regarding the presence of lymphocytes, we are almost sure that they are lymphocytes. But regarding their type, whether they are T or B cells, we have to go after some immunoprotective stains or so on. Now, for electron microscopy, most of these are blocks. And I doubt if, you know better, that if we go to electron microscopy on paraffinized tissue, what we get is not really that exciting. So we hope to be able to get some cases of post-polio that are more or less fresh, and even if they are formalin fixed, still they might be useful to identify the virus. We hope to be able to sort of do a probing on the, you know, spinal cord to see if we can identify the RNA or DNA of the polioviruses in the spinal cord in this patient, especially the 9 months, because that is an active, very active thing. And even that is too exciting. You know, in the literature, as I mentioned, the two references that I gave you, the Bettina Warburg for 1 year and James Pierce for, I think, 19 weeks, 18 and a half weeks, these are the only people who really have had a chance or have done this study on what goes on between the two extremes of the disease.
Rostov, London. One comment, it is possible to look at lymphocyte subtypes on formalin fixed and paraffin embedded sections. There are techniques for doing that, and I can give you a reference.
Yes, we plan to do that.
And my question is, if you take other patients that have had acute systemic viral illnesses, would there be control data from spinal cords of them to show that there were long-term, as it were, inflammatory events, as shown by lymphocytic infiltration? Because I, too, am enormously surprised at the number of inflammatory cells so many years later. But it would be nice to know if other equivalent viral episodes produced a similar sort of long-term sequeling.
The most common type of encephalitis that I have observed are the sort of the ones that we see with the horses, usually the St. Louis and Eastern equine encephalitis and other things that we see around here in the United States, on the eastern part of the United States. These have been mostly on autopsy material.
Herpes,
yes. Yes, that's... Yes, sir.
Windebank, Rochester. Apart from the severity of the neuronal loss in the post-polio
progressing patients in the lumbar cord, which could be old changes. Were there any other changes to distinguish those parts of the cord?
Yes, you see, you know, in elderly, if suppose, let me give you an answer on a different level. Suppose you look at the brain of a 95-year-old man.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over now and continue listening on side two.